This is Greg Smith with the National Educational Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Alyssa Hadley-Dunn at Michigan State University, who has written a number of provocative articles about teacher resignation letters and the often unacknowledged reasons behind the high rate of teacher attrition in the United States. Alyssa, what piqued your interest in studying teacher attrition broadly, and then teacher resignation letters more specifically? Why should we care about this phenomenon?
A few years ago, I wanted to study teacher morale and empowerment in urban schools, and I did. But what I found was actually a lot more disempowerment and low morale. So many of the teachers that I talked to and worked with were leaving, and many of my former colleagues actually contacted me when they were thinking about leaving because they knew I had left. I had been an urban high school English teacher. And then actually my former students who I'd prepared to be teachers started contacting me, wanting to know what was it like to leave and what does it mean if you stay if you know that current policies are harming learning. They saw me, because I had gone to get my PhD after teaching, as a teacher leaver and wanted to know about it. And then after that, they started prefacing these questions with these links to teacher resignation letters that had gone viral online. This is how I feel, I remember one former student telling me. Does that mean I should leave too? And so what I found is that there were actually a lot of teacher resignation letters online. And it seemed like every time someone wrote one, that it automatically went viral. And there were so many other educators around the country who found resonance or who found commonality with the letter writer's experiences that they just started sharing over and over again. And so I think that that is really why we have to care. Because even though there may be only a few letters a year that go viral, there's actually so many more teachers leaving and so many teachers thinking of leaving because they feel beaten down by the system in which they feel like they have no voice or no empowerment.
So how much of a problem is teacher attrition in the United States? And how does this compare to other countries?
So, you know, the teacher shortage is in the news a lot right now, as it is at the beginning of every school year. But we actually have decades of research showing that there's not actually a shortage. It's, as you say, it's this problem of supply, of recruitment and retention. So there was recently a study put out by Linda Darling-Hammond about the attrition rate being 16%. So we have the teachers, they're just not going to the schools where they're needed most, or they're not staying. In other countries that have teachers more involved in the policymaking process, they actually have lower rates of attrition.
So one of the critical things was providing ways for teachers to be participants in decision-making at the school.
Right.
So what commonalities or patterns did you find in the viral teacher education letters?
We found a lot. And so let me just start by mentioning my collaborators in some of this work as well. My colleague from Michigan State, Dr. Jennifer Vanderhyde, and our doctoral students here, Matthew DeRue, Amy Gunther, Scott Farver, and Lindsay Wexler. And so as a team, we did three studies on teacher resignation letters. And across them, we found that teachers, whether they were from New York or North Carolina or Texas or Illinois, they were experiencing the current neoliberal policy context in much the same way. So they felt like learning had been reduced to teaching to the test, that their students' learning opportunities had been curtailed, and that their own voices as teachers were continuously being silenced. One said that he felt like the profession had left him before he was even able to leave it. And what was interesting was that we found this was true whether the teachers had been teaching for 1 or 2 years, or for some writers, like up to 25 years. And they were really frustrated with this neoliberal turn in education, with everything being reduced to a competition. And they, no matter which state context they were in, they were constantly dealing with top-down mandates and increasing bureaucracy at the same time as they saw their salaries and their benefits stagnating or actually even decreasing in some places. So we found that overall, the letters paint a very stark reality of teaching in public schools today, and it's unfortunately not a pretty picture.
You mentioned neoliberal education reforms. Could you say more about neoliberalism for our listeners?
Sure. So neoliberalism, depending on which scholars you ask, they would say that it's a school of thought, it's an ideology, some might even call it a social movement, but overall it's a set of economic beliefs in favor of market-based competition and privatization, and it's developed a real stronghold in political and educational discourse. So neoliberals believe a few things. They believe that the state should not be involved in economic or social life. And really the core of their beliefs is an inherent focus on the market. Not just that the market exists, but that there should be nothing but the market. And so when these market principles are applied to education, we see that parents and students become the buyers or the consumers, and instruction, and thus instructors, the teachers, become the products and the services rendered. So the rationale is that schools will improve too if they're in competition with one another, and we allow market forces to commodify education. Chomsky says, for example, that this is valuing profit over people.
Now, many of these reforms were implemented during the George Bush and Barack Obama administrations. How do you see them playing out in the Trump administration?
Well, unfortunately, I don't see them getting better. But that's kind of the strange thing about neoliberalism. So even though it has liberal in the title, people from across the political spectrum tend to find commonality, or, you know, there's this strange bedfellows that come out in neoliberal reform because of this emphasis on privatization.
Now, in one of your studies, you followed up with teachers to learn more about their stories. What did you find when you interviewed them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was fascinating. I really wanted to hear from the teachers directly about their purpose for writing the letters, and then really what happened after they got such social media attention. And so first we found that none of them actually thought that it would go viral, and that wasn't their intent at all. In fact, they wrote it for a very small audience. Maybe it was just for their principal or for their colleagues, their family, their local union. But then it all really took off from there after either they or a friend put it on social media. I was also surprised to learn that they had not used other resignation letters as models. So many of them actually didn't know that other resignation letters like this existed until after their own letters went viral. And then they found out that they were among this kind of odd little happenstance community of public teacher resigners. What they really wanted to do was to take a stand in a way that they felt they couldn't when they were teaching. So they were very clear about this. They did not want to blame their colleagues for staying, but they were just saying that individually they couldn't do it anymore, that they felt complicit in a broken system. So what I argue in one of the papers is that their letters were in some ways their final act of teaching, and that they were engaging in scholarship for the public to teach the public and to teach policymakers about what day-to-day life is really like for students and teachers today.
Could you say more about what it is that led teachers to feel that they were being silenced, and that it was very difficult for them to raise their voices about issues that concerned them when they were still in the classroom and working in the schools?
So they felt like standardized testing, teacher evaluation, all of these policies were really being implemented from the top down, and that even though they were the experts in what was happening in the classroom, they had no say in not just the policies as they were created, but how they were implemented in their local context.
And so it's actually just the opportunity to speak within their own schools or districts that really has been a source of inhibition for them. Did they talk at all about the different level of evaluation and observation and almost surveillance that's going on in schools these days?
Yes, they definitely did. They said they felt like they were under a microscope a lot of the time, and that the current evaluation systems were kind of doing the opposite of what they were supposed to do, which was to improve instruction. And that, I mean, we have decades of research, right, showing that value-added models of teacher evaluation don't work and they're not being used how they should. We have national statements that, you know, from the American Statistical Association and from AERA saying that they shouldn't be used in the way that the federal and state policymakers are using them. And now we also have teachers saying that the way that they are being evaluated and the way that their students are being evaluated as well is not working.
In your article, you talk about public resignation letters as a form of micro-political activism. Is there any evidence that resignation letters are impacting the thinking of school administrators or educational policymakers?
You know, I asked the teachers this when I interviewed them, if they thought that their letters made a difference in their local context or beyond. And for some, they unfortunately said that their principals never even commented on it, even though they knew it went viral, which to me actually makes an even better argument for why they should have written it in the first place.
Yes.
But for others, they said that, you know, maybe their colleagues were inspired to start more organizing. But unfortunately, none of the teachers spoke directly to if this impacted administration or policy.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that an interesting thing has happened since my research came out in relation to this question. So my university, Michigan State, wrote a press release about the three studies, and somehow it got picked up by a lot of people. And I was so happy and so surprised. So Diane Ravitch wrote about it, the NEA, the teachers union, wrote about it online and then in their monthly magazine. And so as a result of this press, I have been contacted by hundreds and hundreds of teachers and administrators, like almost 1,000 at this point, honestly. And some of those have been administrators who have said that this is helping them think about how to better support their faculty so that their teachers don't leave. I had one from an administrator who said that they're using the letters to structure their new teacher orientations. And another from a district official who said they're going to institute ongoing support groups for veteran teachers. So that was really exciting to hear. I haven't heard directly from any policymakers, but I'm waiting and I'm ready.
Good. I hope some do contact you. What about the teachers themselves who've contacted you as they reflect upon their own experiences as it relates to the viral teacher education letters, as well as its impact on your current and future investigations?
Like I said, it's been mostly teachers who have contacted me, and they're really just saying how much the letters resonated with them, how they could have written what was in the letters. A lot of them said that they cried while reading the articles and the teachers' letters. Some said they felt vindicated to know that they're not alone, how they're glad to see that research is being done on this. And, you know, the articles have been downloaded almost 10,000 times online. And that's,
really?
That's crazy to me. And that's so meaningful to me, because I think if we're going to talk about having a quote impact in educational research, the impact that I want to have is that teachers feel like their voices are being represented in my work and that it can be used to make a difference in their current working conditions. So it's really meaningful to me that the teachers have contacted me. And it has, to your question, it has shaped a lot of how I'm thinking about what this means in terms of who's leaving and why, in relation to the impact that the current political context under Trump will have on teacher attrition and teacher pedagogy while these teachers are in the classroom. So right now I'm working on a project with two colleagues, Beth Sondell and Hannah Carson Baggett, about what it was like to teach after the election, like in the day and week after the 2016 presidential election. How did teachers respond to the trauma that students had experienced and were experienced? So I'm really curious about how long teachers will be able to work amidst not just these ongoing neoliberal policies, but also how will they work with the addition of what I think we can foresee as more constraints and more oppressive policies that are going to be enacted by the Trump administration and Betsy DeVos?
From one perspective, the resignation of the teachers you identified could be seen as a good thing. Get rid of the nonconformist troublemakers, something that seems to be happening at the National Football League at the moment. From your perspective, what's lost when teachers like these leave the profession?
I think so much is lost, so much. And as I argue in one of my other papers about teacher morale, we see so many teachers leaving who are committed to social justice because they feel at odds with working in an unjust system. But these are exactly the type of teachers that we should want teaching our children. These are the teachers who will fight for our children, who teach critical thinking, who support students in and out of the classroom, who use culturally relevant and sustaining pedagogy. And now this doesn't mean, right, that the teachers who stay don't use these things. But I think if we continue to let working conditions exist as they are, we will see more and more teachers like this leaving the profession, which is at great risk to teaching and learning, because we want teachers who can speak truth to power, who can push boundaries, and who, quote, make trouble.
What have you learned about what schools could be doing from your research to change in ways that would increase the retention rate for teachers across public school settings and actually make sure that the kinds of teachers that you've been talking about remain in the classroom?
Yeah, so I think the biggest change is this, that schools need to listen to teachers. Even if some schools now feel like they are listening to teachers, I would challenge those administrators to ask the teachers if they feel like they're being listened to. We know that policies cannot only be implemented from the top down and then enforced without question. So this includes everything from standardized testing to curriculum guidelines and benchmarks and pacing guides to daily schedules and to teacher evaluation like we talked about. So there is no end to what teachers are asked to do these days, but they're asked for their opinions on very little. So I think the first thing policymakers and administrators at all levels need to do is to invite teachers to the table, to take them seriously, and to treat them as the experts that they are, so that they can be really involved in the policy creation and implementation process.
I was involved in a long-term project in Dayton, Ohio, a number of years ago as a researcher. And one of the aims of that particular project was to, in fact, engage teachers in conversations with school administrators and civic leaders. But one of the things that I found that happened was that space wasn't really created within the context of those meetings for teachers to raise their voices. What kinds of things could you imagine happening to make sure that if given those opportunities, the hierarchical structures of schools don't end up fostering even more of that silence?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So when I say that teachers have to be listened to, I don't mean, fill out a survey and so therefore teachers have given their opinion and we read the survey in a very cursory manner, and then we implement whatever policy we had in mind ahead of time. I think that the current way that schools are structured in this hierarchical way, as you mentioned, really is a disadvantage to the type of teacher leadership that would benefit having teachers stay longer and would benefit the students. So in our teacher education classes, we talk a lot about collaboration and creating not just teacher collaborations, but student collaborations and teaching kids how to work in groups. Yet we don't actually model this in the way that schools are currently structured, with giving teachers a voice at all levels.
With regard to teacher education programs, are there other kinds of strategies that people might pursue to at least prepare people for the kinds of working conditions that they're going to face and help support them?
Mm-hmm. So I think this is a really delicate balance, right? And this is one that I struggle with a lot, because I want to tell my teacher candidates what schools are really like, but I also want them to go in with hope. I don't want to destroy their notions of what education can be by reinforcing so much of what it is. So in a way, I am trying to prepare them for a world that doesn't exist and trying to help them figure out how to create it. So I think in teacher education, one thing we can do is we can work with local districts and schools to improve mentoring and induction for beginning teachers, not just kind of drop off this mentoring relationship when they leave our teacher education classrooms. This is work that my colleague Randy Stanulis is doing great work here in Michigan. And I think we also have to really help our teacher candidates see that teaching doesn't have to be an island. We need to help them build teacher networks before they even get into the classroom, so they feel like they are not the only one doing this justice-oriented work when they get there. So in teacher education, this might look like working within and across universities to create and sustain teacher activist groups or other networked collaborative communities, either virtually or in person, that help them in their first years and beyond.
I know as a former teacher educator myself, one of the challenges I encountered in the last years that I was working was a real ethical dilemma about preparing often idealistic and very committed young people to go into a work setting that I knew would be very, very difficult and potentially damaging. How do you negotiate that kind of ethical dilemma yourself as well as your colleagues?
Well, that is a really good question. I actually, with one of my former students turned teachers, turned teacher leavers, I wrote a piece about this. And I can't remember the exact title, but it was like Preparing or Prepared to Leave, because kind of what I was talking about at the beginning of the interview, I keep getting contacted by my former students who I have so much hope and love and joy for, thinking about them as teachers. And then they fall into the same pattern of public school teachers, especially urban teachers, leaving within 3 to 5 years. So I honestly don't have a good answer to that question, other than that I continue to believe that education can be a source for liberation, and that if we prepare strong teachers to work together and work with their students, that if there is a space where it could get better, then the classroom is that space.
This reminds me of one of your articles that, as I recall, was entitled The Courage to Leave, in which you say that teachers need to demonstrate courage both to stay in the classroom as well as the courage to leave when it feels important to do so. Could you say more about your thinking about courage and education?
So I talked about the courage to leave as kind of a play on Parker Palmer's The Courage to Teach. And I think for so many teachers, they, and I should say we, see teaching as a vocation. It's something that so many people grew up thinking they would do. And so the idea that you get into a profession and it is not what you thought it was, and you feel like potentially you are doing more harm than good, how do you have the courage to say, I am not the teacher that I want to be, and I want to fight for students, but maybe this is not the place where I can do it. So I think that we have to expand our definition of what it means to be a courageous teacher, both in starting the profession, in staying in the profession, and in leaving the profession. And I think actually that the teachers who wrote these resignation letters are a good demonstration of that courage.
So, given all of this, what message do you think policymakers should be taking from your research? What changes could they be introducing to the educational system at the state or federal level to improve working conditions for teachers?
Oh my goodness, how much time do we have?
Probably be 3 or 4 minutes before we have to stop.
Well, as I said before, I think that policymakers need to see that teachers' voices are really important in the policy process. And I should add, of course, students are, right? So just as teachers are rarely consulted. Of course, students are even more rarely asked for their opinions on the policies that we know deeply and personally impact their learning and their future. So I think at the state and federal level, we need to see more attention to unstandardizing the curriculum, to recognizing that so much standardized testing has led to more harm than good, and that so much of what is important to learn cannot be measured on these so-called objective tests, which, you know, we know are not ever really objective, right? As we talked about earlier, I think we need to see a rollback of teacher evaluation measures that emphasize value-added models. And I think we need to support teachers' rights for bargaining and organizing, to stop attacking teachers' unions and start recognizing the importance of teacher leadership and teacher communities, and what this will mean for not just keeping strong, justice-oriented teachers in the profession, but also inducting a whole new generation of teachers who can fight for our students.
Do you see any contradiction between this vision of education and the role that schools have oftentimes played in basically socializing people to the current social order? It sounds as though you really see teachers as change agents, whereas many people in the society may not want those changes. How do you reconcile that?
I think you're right. I think actually just last week I was talking with my first year teacher education students. So they're 18, they're just out of high school. And we were talking about the purpose of schooling and whether schooling was achieving its original purpose. And, you know, what were those purposes? Was it to prepare citizens, to prepare workers? And we read a bunch of things. And then I actually posed them with the argument, well, what if school actually is achieving its purpose? What if it is socializing us into the exact order that we are supposed to be in? You know, school wasn't designed for everyone in the first place. It is a racist and a sexist institution. And, but that doesn't mean that it has to stay that way. So I think acknowledging that the structural and systemic and institutional challenges in schools do exist, naming those, I think, is the first step in thinking about how we can create schools in more justice-oriented ways.
So do you have any final thoughts about the way work conditions are driving good teachers from America's schools, and what our listeners might do to address this situation?
Final thoughts. I have a lot.
Great.
I think, as I said earlier, I don't think that things are going to be getting better for teachers and students. And and we can't ignore that. We can't ignore that teachers are kind of on the front lines of responding to students' trauma amidst current political conditions. And so we need to, I think, support teachers more than ever to do the good work that they can do if we just give them a chance.
Well, many thanks to Dr. Alyssa Hadley Dunn of Michigan State. And thanks to our listeners for being with us for this month's podcast. November's Education Interview of the Month will be with Ken Zeichner at the University of Washington. That conversation will explore the creation of independent teacher education programs and their implications for public schools. We invite you to join us again for another podcast.